for our 2021 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni. And given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so again this year in a virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer two CLE polling questions. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling questions. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling questions. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewing of this program. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If they are unable to answer during the live program, our speakers will connect with you via email after the program. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. Please visit www.bli.polsinelli.com for additional information, including CLE application statuses, a detailed view of this year's schedule, and more. We look forward to connecting with you throughout the summer and coming back together in person next year. I'd now like to pass it over to my colleague to kick off today's program.
Good afternoon, good morning, depending where you are. We'd like to thank you for joining us for this 2001 Business Law Institute presentation. My name is Tony Terrain, and I am a shareholder in the Washington, D.C. office. I, along with my colleagues, Lindsay Ryan, Angelo Spinola, and Jason Weber, will be presenting to you ways and best practices for navigating 2021's minefield of unique challenges for employers. Unless you lived under a rock, and even so, you may be under a rock because of social distancing, you know that the 2020 pandemic, COVID-19, the pandemic, has changed the way that we've worked across the board, from in-person work to remote, and a lot of statutes and legislation has been passed from Congress on down to state legislatures, and even to local and city councils have passed legislation to address the COVID-19 vaccine, to provide for additional forms of leave. And so today we're just going to address a few of those and hopefully help you as employers to develop plans and procedures for either returning back to work, continuing remote work, vaccine policies, and we will also provide a general landscape of the employment laws around the country, state and federal and even local, and forecast the future under the Biden administration as appropriate. So we thank you for joining us, and we will begin with teleworking considerations. Now, at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of people resorted to working remotely because even with meeting and conferencing, we are able to use Zoom and other electronic conferencing platforms to see each other, share documents, where we would otherwise be required to be in person. We had this technology for probably over 20 years, but the pandemic last year forced us to utilize it in a way to make our operations more efficient while we had to be socially distant to stop the spread. And so because of that, a lot of employers are, and even yourself, are considering whether we should return to work in person, provided the job allows for that, or whether we should mandate vaccines for people to come in, whether we should encourage people to take vaccines. But first, we will address teleworking considerations to the extent that you as an employer would like to continue remote working. There are legal and practical considerations that we have to take into account as we continue remote working, or if we decide to continue that as a practice. So we'll start with the legal considerations. Now, a lot of employers have asked me questions, and I'm sure the team, about whether employees can refuse to come to work based on a general fear of contracting COVID-19. Do we have to allow employees to telework? And there are two theories. One here is on the slide is at the beginning of the pandemic, many attorneys and legal thinkers analyzed the generalized fear under OSHA regulations, which essentially said that an employee can refuse to work after notifying the employer of a dangerous condition or a hazard if, as you see on the slide, if the employee reasonably believes that they're in imminent danger. A reasonable person would believe the same thing. Due to the urgency of the situation, there's not enough time for the employer to eliminate the danger, and the danger cannot be a generalized fear and must be real and identifiable. Now, the reason why people were analyzing this is because the employers wanted to know whether employees could use this as a means for refusing to come to work in person. Now, generally, there haven't been any cases that have supported this argument generally, but again, there's still time and stranger things have happened. But the reason why this is such a high bar specifically for the COVID-19 vaccine is because the pandemic is a generalized fear to the public, right? So it's not individual to any specific person or workplace, except for, in unique circumstances, healthcare workspaces. And the urgency of the situation element generally isn't there because employers have time to make various adjustments to avoid the spread of the pandemic in their workplaces. So those specific considerations generally would take out the COVID-19 or fear of the COVID-19 pandemic as what's called a direct threat of being exposed to a hazard under the OSHA regulations. However, as I indicated before, there is still time, and I'm sure that there are some attorneys and employees who are trying to use this as a method or as a way to refuse to come to work. Now, there's a Supreme Court case, Whirlpool Corp. versus Marshall, which says employers don't have to pay employees for a refusal to work under the OSHA statute. However, the regulations forbid retaliation for seeking protection. So if there is a legitimate fear under these regulations, then we can't terminate or commit any adverse employment action because they express that fear. However, if they don't come to work, we're not required to pay just because they're on our rosters. So again, there's something to be mindful of. The OSHA regulations generally won't allow an employee to refuse to come to work, but I am anticipating, if there are not already cases out there, that they are gearing up to use that as a justification for refusing to come to work. The other method would be under the ADA. It may be a reasonable accommodation for employers to continue to allow various employees to work from home or telecommute to the extent they can. Now, again, as I have there, the interactive process is still required. So, the classic example for a fear that is debilitating enough to constitute a disability under the ADA would be anxiety or a similar mental fear-based disorder or impairment that would forbid somebody from working or impair somebody from working or any other major life activity. So, in that case, we may have a duty through the interactive process to allow somebody with legitimately diagnosed anxiety to continue to work from home. But other than that, again, if short of that, if there's another way to allow the person to work, that's not an automatic, they don't automatically get the right to work from home. So just another consideration. You have the OSHA standard, which is not as likely to justify a refusal to return to work. But then you have the ADA, which is more likely. And even before the pandemic, there was a lot of case law discussing whether telecommuting or working from home was a reasonable accommodation. So even so now, there has probably already been an uptick in individuals claiming that they have a disability to try to stay home. Outside of anxiety or any fear-based disorder that is really a disability, again, the ADA probably would not support a desire to work from home if there are no other reasonable alternatives. So just to put you on notice, do we have to allow people to work from home? In cases, it depends, but not necessarily. And do we have to allow individuals who have disabilities to work from home? Again, it depends on the disability, but it's just something for us to think about. Now, employers who just are deciding to allow their employees to continue to work from home have to consider various federal and state laws and local laws considerations that will affect that decision. For example, wage and hour laws are different in different states. If you're a national employer or if you're an employer that allows somebody to work remotely and they work in a different state frequently enough, they may be subject to those minimum wage and overtime laws there. In addition, there are meal and rest break laws, for example, in California and other states, that employers who have employees working there may be required to follow. So before we start implementing a policy to allow our employees to continue to work from home, we have to consult those wage and hour laws to determine that we will comply with them by allowing the employee to work from wherever location they work. And this includes situations. There was a on the news, there was a young lady who made like travel blogs about working in different locations around the world. Now, that may not necessarily apply because she was not in one place for long enough for it to matter for it to be under the wage and hour laws of that jurisdiction. However, this shows you the example of how, as we have expanded remote working, individuals have taken the liberties to not just work in their home state, but to travel and work wherever they can or have internet access or can log on. Another factor to consider is reimbursement for work-related expenses. For example, in California, employers are required to provide reimbursement for reasonable and necessary costs incurred as a condition of continued employment. That could be, you know, having to buy a printer if you're an accountant, or having to buy ink for the printer, or having to buy a computer if the company doesn't provide you one. Now, if we have a policy requiring individuals to return to work, or a policy that allows employees to return to work but for them to decide, it may not be necessary for them to buy the printer, because they could come into work, you know, short of having a disability that prevents that, they can come into work and use our equipment there. So, again, analysis of the laws relevant to the states where which you operate has to be performed by the company before we can just go out and say you can work from home. Another example of the expenses is in New York, employers who fail or neglect or refuse to pay benefits or wage supplements within 30 days are guilty of a misdemeanor. And wage supplements includes the payment of or reimbursement of business expenses. Furthermore, there's an opportunity for liquidated damages for failure to pay wages. So again, by not doing our due diligence and understanding how the laws operate where we work, we could risk huge liability just by an oversight. I'll give you another example. In Maryland, unless there's a bona fide dispute in the amount of wages, employees who sue can get treble damages. So, again, if you're working in Maryland but the employer is somewhere else and I'm subject to these laws and I'm not adhering to those laws, there's a huge risk that you can even pay three times the amount that you would normally be due. So it's important that we understand the status of reimbursements in the states where we work, whether they constitute wages, and make sure that we implement a policy that complies. Another consideration is safe remote workspaces. So if injuries occur in the course of, they arise out of and incur in the course of employment, generally the employer is liable for workers' comp. There are a whole bunch of jurisdictional issues, especially if a remote employee works in another state, as to whether the employer has insurance that covers that jurisdiction. But these, again, as another consideration, is the employee generally has to prove that the injury is work-related. So if a house plant falls in my leg and fractures one of my toes, that is probably not going to be work-related, right? But however, if I develop carpal tunnel frequent typing, or probably a data processing job or position that where I'm working remote and I develop carpal tunnel, that is more likely to be a compensable injury. So it's just important to be mindful that employers could be liable for things like workers' comp, even in a remote working setting. Other considerations are exempt employees. A lot of people just think that if they title somebody a manager and pay them a salary, that they're automatically exempt. However, there's a duties test that employers have to take in order to understand whether the duties of a position are truly exempt. Otherwise, you could face violations and lawsuits from the DOL and employee suits for misclassification. An exempt employee who's working from home may be working doing non-exempt duties, work over 40 hours, and you're paying them a salary and not considering whether you have to pay overtime, whether that be time and a half for hours over 40 or hours over 8, depending on the jurisdiction. So it's important to monitor and have frequent communication with your remote workforce to ensure that the exempt employees are just only doing exempt work. There are circumstances where normally exempt employees may not be doing exempt work because they are not managing other employees in a remote setting. So, again, it's a constant evaluation of the duties to determine that the whether the exemption that applies, if any, is appropriate. The other situation is use of the employer's equipment at home. A lot of employees will assume because they're working from home that they have a privacy right in their email or the data stored on the employer's computer, which is not the case. And even there are certain circumstances where the employer can monitor their equipment even in the employee's home. Some states require advance notice for that. And so, again, you should be mindful to consult the state laws regarding that. However, monitoring is actually a good way, so assuming you can do that and assuming that you provide adequate notice, to confirm what the employee is doing while they're at home, how often they're working, how productive they're being at home. And so, again, we can consider whether we can track, even in cell phones, tracking company cell phones, tracking the employee's work at home. And in even state leave laws, and Angela will discuss in more greater detail new laws that have come out in this regard. But again, if you have employees working remotely in other jurisdictions and they are entitled to various forms of paid sick leave, paid family leave, or what have you, based on where they're working, and in your state then that may not necessarily be the case, it's important that we know that ahead of time and include that in any plan to continue remote working. And again, this is a more of a practical consideration, but to the extent that we have managers overseeing other employees in the workforce, we need to have sufficient training to allow those managers to remotely track progress, engage in performance management, give corrections, give proper feedback to employees remotely. So again, these are just certain considerations that we need to take into account while we're working remotely. Ultimately, the main suggestion is that, and the best practice is that employees consult the state and local and federal laws, determine the parameters and what throughout these considerations, the parameters of what we are willing to do, evaluate our positions, and develop a comprehensive teleworking policy that will ensure consistency across the board. The policy should consider the duties of each position, the employer's expectations for performance, including a delineation of work time versus personal time, what constitutes adequate or sufficient performance at home, when do we expect you to be working, and again, applicable federal, state, and local laws. Once we develop a teleworking policy that is robust and comprehensive enough to cover everyone equally and provide consistent, reliable, and predictable outcomes, then we need to make sure it's clearly communicated to all affected employees and in writing so that way we can always refer back to it and to ensure consistency among various workforces. So now I will turn the presentation over to Ashley for a polling question.
Great. Thank you so much. This is the first CLE polling question for today's program. You must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. Has your company implemented a telecommuting policy? Please select yes or no and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your internet browser and try again. Again, has your company implemented a telecommuting policy? Select yes or no and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you are having issues submitting, please email events@pulsinelli.com. Again, that's events@pulsinelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another minute to respond. Please select yes or no and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner. And if you are not seeing it on your computer or device, please refresh your internet browser and try again. Going to give you guys another 20 seconds. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and pass it off to Jason. Thank you so much.
Good morning. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Weber. I'm a shareholder with Pulsinelli's Dallas office. To echo Tony's comments, we appreciate all of you making time to be here today. We're going to go ahead and shift gears now and talk about some of the legal and practical considerations regarding return to work issues. So first off, as many of you recognize, in a perfect world, all the laws would be harmonious. We wouldn't have a problem enforcing one policy or one legal rule in exchange for another. However, that's not the reality. And unfortunately, the laws don't always mesh, just as an employer's and an employee's objectives don't necessarily always align. A perfect example of this has been within the context of the pandemic this past year, where we had situations such as this, for example, within the context of employers trying to manage workplace safety, that didn't always necessarily jive with how employers were trying to handle employee privacy issues. And so as we look to returning to the workplace, there's essentially two buckets of issues that we're generally looking at. On the one hand, we have the legal considerations that employers need to be mindful of. Those typically can be summarized as issues involving workplace safety, accommodations issues, employee privacy issues. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have to navigate some of the practical considerations. And those practical considerations have been particularly exacerbated within the context of COVID-19, given some of the polarizing aspects of this, some of the political the political nature that some of these considerations entail. And so as employers start to navigate these issues and to start to think about reopening or actually do start implementing a reopening policy, these types of practical considerations are particularly important. When we talk about the practical considerations, we're looking at issues such as the employee morale, what are the public relations considerations, and not just the behavioral aspects of that, but what are the actual physical constraints? What are the constraints on what the employer can do from a position of social distancing, accommodating workplace needs, and so forth? And so, as we start to look at this, employers need to be mindful of how are we going to prepare for a return to the workplace. And when we talk about that, preparation is everything. This is not an issue where you shoot first and you think later. Employers need to be particularly thoughtful and deliberate about how they prepare for a return to the workplace. And when we talk about that, we're going to hit on three high points. Those can essentially be summarized as, first, we want to develop a return to work plan. Second, we want to actually communicate that return to work plan with employees. And finally, we want to make sure that the process in which we implement that return to work plan is systematic and it's done in a thoughtful manner. So with respect to the first issue, when employers are looking at developing a return to the work plan, what they want to do is determine what are the objectives and what are the risks that are at issue. In other words, what would the employer like to do and why is the employer wanting to return to the workplace now? There has been an inclination for some employers to naturally gravitate towards wanting to immediately open the workplace for everyone. And while that may be appropriate in some context, it's not necessarily always appropriate for everyone. An overarching theme is that this is fact specific, and each employer needs to do what is appropriate within that industry and even within that specific office or even department. When employers look at this, they also need to be mindful of what are the risks associated with what the employer's objectives are. And so when an employer is evaluating what it wants to do, it needs to be mindful of the various federal, state, and local orders. And for multi-state employers, that's particularly important because what may be permissible in one state or one local area is not necessarily going to be the same for elsewhere. And so as employers start to navigate this, as an initial starting point, they need to be mindful of what is the baseline requirements for the particular areas where the employer is looking to reopen. An additional component that employers also need to be mindful of is as employees are called back, if there are instances where employees are not called back or are permanently laid off, is that going to create other types of issues that may require worn-out considerations and so forth. When employers are looking at the return to work options, they also need to think about what are the options that are available. And what I always counsel clients on is that you're essentially left to your own creativity as to how you manage this. On the one end of the spectrum, some employers may think that it's appropriate to open the entire office back up to everyone. Conversely, on the other end of the spectrum, employers may continue to have remote options available for everyone. In between, there's other options where employers may be considering some sort of incremental return to workplace where there may be staggered shifts, or there could also be a hybrid option where one portion of the workplace returns to the work and another portion of the workplace stays at home. And as you navigate that, you need to be mindful of thinking about why is it that we're seeking to implement what it is we're wanting to do. With respect to communicating the work plan, this is particularly important. Oftentimes, employers encounter more problems when they fail to effectively communicate the objectives to the employees in advance. And the purpose of communication is twofold. First, it highlights for employees what the expectations are. And highlighting those expectations will often result in greater collaboration and the reduced risk of potential employee morale issues resulting from these types of issues. Second, it also sets the expectations for what is expected. And so when employers are doing this, they need to ensure that they're providing transparency and communicating exactly what it is that is expected as to return to workplace measures are implemented. With respect to managing the employee concerns, it's particularly important that reinforcing the positive benefits of a return to workplace are accomplished in that we address individualized concerns on a case-by-case basis. So with respect to implementing a return to work, a safe work environment remains critical, and we need to train all employees on health and safety protocols, and we need to screen and require employees to self-screen for COVID symptoms. And so just because we're reopening training all employees on health and safe protocols is particularly important for encouraging social distancing and good hygiene. And so we want to be mindful of the OSHA's general duty clause for providing a safe work environment for with respect to the OSHA's safe general duty clause, we need to be mindful of providing a safe work environment for I think I'm having some technical difficulties on this. So OSHA has been criticized for not doing enough for pushing for increased resources with respect to So OSHA has been criticized for not doing enough for pushing for increased resources
Hey Jason, I think you're cutting in and out here for a second. Your phone connection.
Okay, I think I have it back. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Yep.
Okay,
yep,
I'm sorry. So with respect to this, we need to be mindful of some of the risk areas for a work plan. For example, with OSHA's general duty clause, an employer needs to be mindful of providing a safe work environment. And that's particularly important within the context of an employer environment because an employer has an obligation to provide a safe working environment. And with respect to with respect to the general duty clause, hello? I'm sorry, is it cutting out?
Yep, you are cutting out just in and out
okay.
just a little bit. Yep.
Okay, sorry. With respect to OSHA's general duty clause, there is a duty to provide a safe work environment, and within the context of providing a safe work environment, employers need to be mindful of providing Is it cutting?
Yeah, we're cutting out a little bit. Ashley, do you think we should maybe go to the vaccination section?
Yeah, Jason, we'll kind of get you connected again, and then Lindsay, if we can go ahead and just jump to you for a second.
Sounds good.
Great,
well, I'm actually, and this is Lindsay Ryan. I'm a shareholder in the LA office, and I'm actually going to be talking on a very similar topic to Jason, kind of sticking with the theme of returning to work and specifically talking about COVID-19 vaccines. As more and more businesses prepare to return their employees to the physical workplace, one issue that frequently comes up is whether and how to require or encourage COVID-19 vaccinations for employees. And I could spend an entire presentation on vaccine policies, but I only have 15 minutes, so I'm just going to cover as many of the key issues as possible. And I'm going to start with addressing mandatory vaccine policies. And the most common question we get right now, which is, can employers require employees to be vaccinated as a condition of returning to the workplace? And the short answer to that question is yes, at least under the ADA and Title VII, with some important caveats, of course. But a mandatory policy is still vulnerable to other legal challenges that I will briefly go over, and it presents administrative burdens. So whether you can doesn't always answer the question of whether you should. One of the reasons this is even a question is that under the ADA, an employer cannot require a medical examination or make a disability-related inquiry unless that examination or inquiry is shown to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. However, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, has issued express guidance confirming that vaccinations are not a medical examination, such that at least under the ADA, employers can mandate any COVID-19 vaccine approved or authorized by the FDA, again, subject to certain exceptions that I'll go over. Now, before I go over those exceptions, I do want to point out that all of the guidance that I'm covering today strictly considers federal equal employment laws. But in considering a mandatory vaccine policy, it is also important to consider whether any state or local laws might impose stricter requirements. Additionally, and I have this noted on this slide, a lot of companies have inquired about the fact that all three available COVID-19 vaccines only have emergency use authorization from the FDA and will not have full approval for some time. As the EEOC just recently confirmed, the EUA status of these vaccines does not prevent employers from mandating the vaccine under federal equal employment laws. However, whether there could be other legal implications is a different question. Individuals have a federal statutory right to refuse administration of vaccines authorized under an EUA, but this restriction seems to address the actions of federal officials and not private actors. So this requirement would not seem to prevent employers from adopting a mandatory vaccine policy, but the fact is it's an issue that is going to come up that you're going to hear about, and it technically remains unanswered, though we are already seeing litigation raise this issue. So it's something to be aware of, something to speak with your legal counsel about, and to monitor as we see the courts start to address this issue. Now, getting back to the employment-related laws, although vaccinations themselves might not implicate the ADA, given that they are not a medical examination, pre-screening vaccination questions may implicate the ADA's provision on disability-related inquiries. Healthcare providers have to ask certain questions before administering the vaccine to ensure that there's no medical reason that would prevent the person from receiving the vaccination. So if the employer requires an employee to receive the vaccination from the employer or a third party engaged by the employer to administer the vaccine, then those questions will be deemed to be coming from the employer and will likely be considered disability-related inquiries. So if an employer requires employees to receive a vaccination administered by the employer or the employer's contractor, that employer is going to have to show that these disability-related inquiries are job-related and consistent with business necessity. So the best practice if you're going to be mandating vaccines is to simply have employees receive the vaccine from an independent third party and then request proof of vaccination from those employees. If you're going to have an employer-sponsored program that's voluntary, that's a different situation. That same concern would not exist. But certainly, if it's going to be mandatory and employer-administered, there's going to be some additional concerns. Now, as I mentioned before, there are caveats to a mandatory vaccine policy, namely that employers requiring vaccines have to provide reasonable accommodations to employees who are unable to take the vaccine due to certain medical or religious reasons. And I'm going to start by talking about disability-related accommodations. The most common disability accommodation requests for the COVID-19 vaccine are generally going to be related to allergies to a component of the vaccine or certain autoimmune disorders. General fear of the vaccine is not a disability. However, an anxiety disorder could be, so you have to carefully consider each employee's request and consider them individually. When an employee makes a request for a disability-related accommodation, the employer is going to first want to consider whether that employee, if unvaccinated, would pose a direct threat to the health or safety of the individual or others in the workplace. And that assessment needs to be made before we even get to the consideration of potential accommodations. This would involve an individual assessment of the four factors I have listed on this slide, which I won't go over in detail, but for example, a fully remote worker does not present a direct threat to the workplace. They're not even in the workplace. So they should not be required to comply with an employer's mandatory vaccine policy if they have a disability that prevents them from doing so. But in less obvious cases where the employee is on site, the EEOC instructs employers to really consider the level of community spread at the time, current statements from the CDC, statements from that employee's healthcare provider. You would also want to consider things such as whether that employee works alone or with other people, whether they work outside or inside, how much interaction they have with other employees, how many other employees in the workplace are vaccinated, if you know, and the ability to socially distance and implement other safety measures already in the workplace. Only if a direct threat exists should you then go through the interactive process, just like you normally would, to determine if reasonable accommodations can be made that would reduce that direct threat, provided it does not constitute an undue hardship to the employer. And in the context of disability accommodations, that means a significant difficulty or expense to the employer. Specific examples of potential accommodations might include wearing a face mask or having that unvaccinated individual socially distance, work a modified shift. You may consider making modifications to the workplace like increasing ventilation or limiting contact with others, or maybe having that person submit to testing for COVID-19 periodically. If those accommodations will not work, you could also consider remote work and as a last resort, reassign it to a vacant position. If that direct threat cannot be reduced to an acceptable level through one or some combination of these types of accommodations, then the employee can be excluded from the workplace. But even then, you should be careful not to automatically terminate them as they may be entitled to other accommodations, for example, a limited leave of absence, or they may have other rights under federal, state, or local laws. Now, moving on to religious accommodations, employers also have to provide a reasonable accommodation for the religious belief, practice, or observance of an employee, unless it would pose an undue hardship. And religion in this context is defined broadly, so it refers not only to major well-recognized religions, but also religious beliefs that are new, uncommon, not part of a formal church or sect, only subscribed to by a small number of people, or even those that may seem illogical or unreasonable to the employer. Now, social, political, or economic philosophies will not count as religious beliefs. So, for example, being an anti-vaxxer in itself is not a religious belief, but it can sometimes be a fine line, so you really have to consider each request carefully. And the EEOC instructs employers to assume that an employee's request for religious accommodation is based on sincerely held religious beliefs. However, if there's an objective basis for questioning the religious nature or sincerity of the particular belief, then the employer can request additional supporting information. And it's also good to remember that undue hardship in the context of a religious accommodation means only having more than a de minimis cost or burden on the employer. So it's much easier to prove in the context of religious accommodations. Keep in mind, again, however, that state laws may impose even greater protections or impose higher standards for denying accommodations, depending on where you are located. Now, I've also included a slide on pregnancy because one question that comes up frequently is whether employers need to accommodate employees due to pregnancy. And the answer is a little bit trickier than with disabilities and religious beliefs, but the answer is that both the ADA and Title VII can trigger accommodations for employees based on pregnancy. And when I say pregnancy, that can include breastfeeding or even an intention to become pregnant. Under the ADA, even though pregnancy itself is not a disability, pregnancy-related medical conditions may be. And under Title VII, women affected by pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions have to be treated the same as others who are similar in their ability or inability to work. So pregnant employees may be entitled to very similar accommodations as offered to those for disabilities or religious beliefs. And again, this is an area that can be impacted by state law. Now, to shift gears a little bit, if you do not want to mandate vaccines and assume the various legal risks or administrative burdens that I just went over associated with mandatory policies, there are ways to simply encourage vaccinations. One way is to simply educate employees on the importance of getting vaccinated based on reliable public health sources. Another is to make it convenient and accessible and at no cost to the employee. So in addition to, for example, supplying employees with information regarding when and where they can be vaccinated, this could involve supplying employees with paid time off to get vaccinated. Keep in mind that a number of state and local COVID paid sick leave laws may even require you to do so, even in the absence of a mandatory policy. Making it accessible may also include offering on-site vaccinations administered by the employer or an agent of the employer. And then finally, an employer can consider offering other incentives, some of which I list here. So on the topic of incentives, there's been a lot of questions and uncertainty regarding whether and how employers can legally offer incentives to employees to get vaccinated. And again, we're talking cash, gift cards, paid time off. Fortunately, just a week ago, the EEOC finally issued some long-awaited guidance on this topic, which I'm going to briefly cover in this slide. One of the primary legal issues surrounding the offering of vaccine incentives is that certain incentives could cause the program to be considered part of a wellness program, which can implicate the ADA and HIPAA. However, the EEOC has now confirmed that at least under the ADA, employers can offer incentives to employees to voluntarily provide proof of vaccination from a third party. And by third party, I mean a pharmacy or the employee's medical provider or some independent clinic. And that's because doing so does not involve answering any disability-related inquiries from the employer in exchange for that incentive. Now, employers can also offer an incentive to employees for voluntarily receiving an employer-administered vaccine as well, but in that case, you can only do so if the incentive is not so substantial as to be coercive. In this context, the employer or its agent is asking the pre-screening medical questions, and so a very large incentive could make employees feel pressured to disclose protected medical information to their employer, and that would be impermissible. I've also noted here that employers can offer an employee's family member the opportunity to be vaccinated under certain conditions, but you should not offer the employee an incentive for a family member's vaccination. And again, this guidance from the EEOC is limited to an analysis under the ADA. So there can also be HIPAA wellness rules that are implicated by an incentive program, which I'm not covering here. It doesn't mean that you cannot offer incentives, but I do recommend that you consult Employee Benefits Council before rolling out any incentive programs related to the COVID vaccine. There's a lot of issues to consider, including that you'll want to carefully consider the tax treatment or any wage and hour issues that might be associated with the incentives that you're offering. In evaluating your options for vaccine policies, you may also want to simply survey your employees regarding vaccination status, and it is permissible to do this. simply requesting vaccination status or proof of vaccination is not a disability-related inquiry. However, subsequent questions, such as asking why an individual did not receive vaccination, could elicit information about a disability and would be subject to the ADA standard that such questions be job-related and consistent with business necessity. So the best practice, if you're going to do this, is to simply ask whether the employee is vaccinated as a yes or no question and caution employees not to provide other medical information as part of the proof of vaccination process. Now, even though a request for vaccination status is not a disability-related inquiry, the ADA does still require employees who request this information to maintain it and the documentation confidentially and separate and apart from employee personnel files. Employers should also consider any applicable state laws governing the collection, maintenance, and privacy of this data. And for employers with on-site vaccination clinics, it's important that medical records and other information not be disclosed by the health plan or providers to HR without a proper authorization. In this context, the best practice would simply be to have the employees provide their own proof of vaccination. I will finally conclude with a note that a mandatory vaccination policy should not be considered a get-out-of-jail-free card. Employers still have to carefully consider federal, state, and local laws regarding COVID-19 safety measures, as well as CDC and OSHA guidance. We're starting to see guidance that safety standards can be relaxed in some respects for vaccinated individuals, but within the workplace, employers need to carefully consider how this can actually be done practically and in compliance with applicable employment laws at the federal, state, and local levels. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to our partner in Atlanta, Angelo Spinola, and he will provide a summary of other notable employment developments and maybe even some that are not COVID-19 related.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. There's a reason, guys, that I am in the caboose here. My colleagues know that I am extremely long-winded, so I'm going to do my best. It was me, actually, that was messing with Jason Weber's audio to see if I could get some more time, but that didn't work. So I am going to have to move quick. I will do my best, but that just know that isn't me. So if we don't get to everything, my apologies. Let's start with the political update, just to let everyone know kind of what's going on. All employers are focused in on the PRO Act, right? This act relates to how you organize, how unions can organize workers. It is that there's a reason that we have the world exploding for most employers. This is considered the worst legislation working through Congress. It passed the House on March 9th. It is currently in committee at the Senate. There are a lot of Democratic votes for this. I think 47 is where we're at. Not much Republican support, but let's start with kind of what it does. It makes it much easier to unionize your workforce. It eliminates the ability to use arbitration agreements with class action waivers. It changes the independent contractor test to the ABC test that's used in places like California and Massachusetts, a challenging test to utilize independent contractors. It gets rid of the right to work laws, which means that folks who do not want to be a part of a union would not have the ability to opt out and must still pay union dues. So there's a lot in the PRO Act that folks don't like. And the big question is this going to pass? Is it going to make it through? I'm no Nostradamus, but my prediction is that it does not, unless something happens with the filibuster, because we're not going to get to 60 votes because of the lack of Republican support. Nonetheless, it is something to watch very carefully, because the way these things work in Congress is they come in and they get some support. And sometimes they come back when the composition of Congress changes, and that is likely to occur in our next election. Switching gears quickly to the American Rescue Plan and what has happened there, several laws that impact employers. The one I want to talk about that I think folks don't think about enough is the continuation of paid sick leave. And remember how this worked under the Family First Coronavirus Response Act. Any employer that had fewer than 500 employees was required to provide paid sick leave and paid family medical leave under certain qualifying conditions. And there's 6 qualifying conditions for the paid sick leave, and it was 1 for the family medical leave, which was 10 weeks, extended then to 12 weeks. That one condition was if an employee was caring for children or a dependent that was out of school related to COVID and the pandemic. And what has happened is that's been extended now voluntarily. And the important thing to know about that FFCRA that I don't think people all realize is that if you qualified for that kind of coverage, there was a dollar for dollar tax credit that applied. So really, you know, helpful for employers in that they were able to extend sick leave and medical leave and not have to actually pay for it. The government was paying for it. And now it's not a requirement to use FFCRA, but it is a voluntary program that you can opt into if you do have fewer than 500 employees. And you can see from this statistic from the National Federation of Independent Businesses, it's a survey that was taken. It shows that the taking of leave is actually up from December. When you look at where we are in May as opposed to December, it's about double folks that are taking virus-related leave, which is a bit surprising because I think all of us are believing that we're coming out of the pandemic, but there's still quite a bit of leave that is being taken. So if you are in a state, for example, that already requires you to provide paid sick leave, and you're paying for it out of pocket, and there are 15 jurisdictions right now that are like that, including Washington, D.C., and a few more that are coming online, including New Mexico and some other states. So if you have a requirement to pay for paid sick leave, it might make sense if you would otherwise qualify for the government program to provide for the government program. And so it's just a couple of examples, and we won't go through these in great detail because we've got a very large audience from all around the country. But California recently passed SB 95 in March, and it was a retroactive law back to January, as only California can do. Hey, there's this new law, and it applied to you before you even knew about it. But it applies for anybody that's got more than 26 employees in California. It provides up to 80 hours of supplemental paid sick leave. Supplemental meaning it's on top of any of the other leave requirements, either from the company or the state or the city. You've got to provide this leave in addition. New York has a similar law. It's only 4 hours. This relates to really the issues around the vaccine and getting vaccinated. By the way, the paid leave, the government federal paid leave that I was talking about, that's voluntary, that's a, you know, kind of a continuation of the FFCRA coverage, added 3 different categories for vaccination. Right, vaccine-related issues that would be, you know, side effects going and getting your vaccine. So the same type of things that the New York law is covering, and New York doesn't allow you to require employees to use the FFCRA type leave, right, where you're getting the tax credit over the New York leave, but it's certainly an option. Other states that we're going to see, and this kind of shifting gears to kind of what we're seeing nationally with states creating their own law, not only states creating their own law, cities within states creating their own law. If you have operations in California, you know about all the minimum wages in California and the different city laws that you see cropping up everywhere. Illinois, Nebraska, and Oregon are looking at expanding adopting paid sick leave. Here are some of the other types of law that we see at a state and city level that change. A couple of questions that came in, I'll try to cover briefly. One was when we were talking about the remote workers, right, and telecommuting. Question was, well, do I have to pay, you know, for my employees' internet, their internet usage, if they're using their internet for business-related purposes? And that's one that is going to be state-dependent. If you're in California, the answer to that is probably yes. If you're in Illinois, the answer is probably yes, because there's a law that requires you to reimburse for all business-related expenses. That would also include mileage and travel time and things like that. Cell phone usage, not all states are like that, right? And so each state has different rules, and it's very, very difficult, I think, for companies to keep up with all of those rules. And what we have found is that those laws are changing really at a faster pace than we have ever seen before. And plaintiff lawyers are really taking advantage of that by bringing what I refer to as gotcha-type lawsuits. A gotcha lawsuit would be the type of lawsuit where you're not using the right, you don't have the right information on your pay stub, or you haven't provided a wage theft notice, or you haven't paid somebody upon termination in California. One of these sorts of things that is a strict liability kind of issue. And you're either doing it right or you're not. Background check, you know, are you using the right consent forms, those sorts of things. And one of the things that we've done with our healthcare clients that I'm curious about, we have a poll here, a CLE poll that I'm going to turn over to Ashley in a second, around state programs, right, and creating materials, onboarding materials, state-specific materials for our healthcare clients. It's been really popular. They subscribe into, and I'm curious as to, since we have a national audience of lots of different industries, if that is something that would be useful. This seems to be the complaint that most of our clients have is, how do we keep up? How do we know that we're using the right handbooks, policies, procedures, forms in our states, in our cities? And, you know, Ashley, maybe we can launch that poll now. The question is, is that of interest to you, having a package of materials that you know is compliant but is not necessarily specific to your business for you then to take and customize, or for us to customize for you? So leave that open for a second, and then we will move on to the next section here.
Great. And Angela, I'll just jump in with a few notes. Make sure to select your answer and then hit submit in that lower right-hand corner of the slides box. This is your final CLE polling question for today's program. So make sure to select your answer and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner. If you are having any issues seeing it, please refresh your internet browser and try again. If you do continue to have issues, email events@pulsinelli.com. We'll give you guys another 20 seconds. And Angela, feel free to go with your program if you want to leave this up for just a few more seconds. I know we're running out of time.
All right. So I can get moving? Beautiful. All right. Let us continue then. So another trend that we're seeing, I just wanted to cover, and I know that a lot of you are experiencing this, particularly when we're talking about low-wage earners, right, your lower-wage workforce. We have a record high number of vacancies, over 2 million, that are open, according to a survey done in March, despite the fact that, you know, there's a lot of folks that are on unemployment. And the reason for that, or one of the reasons for that, is the pandemic unemployment assistance, right, which now is at $300 and will remain at $300 through September 6th. What we have seen, you know, at one point it was up to $600, right, under CARES, and then $400, and then back down to $300. And what we've seen is, for particularly when it was really high, for some of the lower wage workers, that they can actually earn more money by not working than by working, which is a real problem, especially when you couple it with the federal program that doesn't require a lot of confirmation that you don't have work available. If there's a fear of returning to the work site, that may be sufficient to collecting those money. So that's a major issue, and one that is a hot button issue in Congress now. The ERC is another area where we're seeing not enough employers probably know about this program, which is the ability to take a credit against the employer's share of Social Security, and allows for 2020 for a $5,000 maximum credit, and it's really seven 7,000 per quarter in 2021. There are two different ways of qualifying. For 20, it was if there was a 50% drop in quarterly revenue in 21, that's only a 20% drop, right? Or if your business was impacted either directly or indirectly by a government shutdown. One thing, so if you haven't explored this and you think you would qualify, we do have a pro at this, a guy that's a real guru that has been working with a lot of our clients. One thing to keep in mind is that the IRS did extend coverage to be able to audit companies who maybe did not have a reasonable basis for taking the credit from 3 to 5 years. So we expect that the IRS is going to be looking carefully at this. So last area for me, and I will then shut up, and I know that there's some questions, and we will get to your questions. It may not be in this program, but anybody who asks questions, we will respond to you. But just quickly, what to expect from the Department of Labor, and then we'll send you back to your days. The DOL is very focused now on independent contracting again, very similar to the Obama administration. Biden has brought back a lot of the same people. Increased funding for investigators. David Weil is going to be the new wage and hour division administrator. He was Obama's wage and hour administrator, very focused on joint employment, which is the idea of crossing liability across different companies, eliminating independent contracting. We'll also see most likely a $15 minimum wage. You know, we saw that in the infrastructure bill initially. That was dropped out because it really doesn't have anything to do with infrastructure. We will see that come up again. That probably is going to be something that is phased in, by the way, for it to pass. It probably is not going to be something that happens overnight, but it's phased in over the course of a number of years. That's at a federal level. I'm talking about higher safety standards. We're seeing that both at an effort at that at a federal level and in several states. Like we talked about, a lot more state and local laws, recruitment and retention issues, particularly on that low wage scale, and unions having a seat back at the table. And I think we'll see probably a spike in unionized workforces. So with that, let me turn it over to Ashley to kind of close us out and give you a couple of housekeeping tips. And we thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much. This concludes today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling questions. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 48 hours. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewings of this program. Thank you all for your participation.